On the evening of February 12, 2020, the country bookshelf was filled to bursting with an enthusiastic crowd of fans and well-wishers gathered to celebrate the publication of Bozeman octogenarian luminary Joanne Troxell's book, Waiting for the Revolution, a Montana memoir, published by Sweetgrass Books. Joanne was introduced by the country bookshelf's Casey Kane Charbonneau.
We're so excited to have everybody here tonight. This is an incredible showing. This is just heartwarming. We're so happy to see the support for local author and friend Joanne Troxell. I could talk for a long time about her, but I'm sure all of you could as well. So let's get started with Joanne.
I'm just a cowgirl looking for a cowboy.
Any cowboys?
I thought about land and cowboys. I come from a long line of cowboys. So today I thought, I'm going to be a cowgirl because that's really what I wrote about in so many ways, were people who were ranch people, who worked on ranches, and who wore jeans, Levi's, and Levi jackets because they lasted the longest. They were not a fashion statement, they were a work statement. In fact, if you got a new pair of Levi's, they were your good Levi's, and then your other Levi's turned out to be your ones you worked in. So you had two pairs of Levi's. And in order to make them fit exactly right, you would jump in the horse's trough. And they would get all wet, and then they'd sort of shrink to your body. So I thought you might like to know a bit about that arcana of cowboys in Montana. And actually, the book starts out with ranch life and pioneers and homesteaders. And they're hardy stock. It's interesting to note that my grandmother had 10 children, and they all grew up to be old people. Kind of an unusual story, really. We all have a certain relationship with land. We all know that. And it may not be Montana originally for you. It may be some other land. And then you came here because maybe there was a promise here. Or maybe something spoiled where you were. That we have dreams about land. And then when land doesn't turn out the way we hoped it would, then we move on. And that happened a lot in California. We saw the migration from California, but what happened, that beautiful, beautiful state got in some ways polluted just by sheer numbers, and so the dream was lost, and they moved here. And our dream here is being challenged right now, isn't it? Mm-hmm. We know that. Bozeman's not the country we came to. And every day I wonder, when did that village spring up? And it's hard sometimes, and we want to live in that memory, that time before, when we were so excited and happy to living in the Bozeman village. But it is not happening anymore, and it will not ever go back. So we have to be here with what is happening now and accept it in some sort of gracious way. I want to talk to you a little bit about being a writer. I had no idea that I would get the reaction I did from a book like this, because when I was writing, I was just trying to solve a problem. I was very focused on, well, how will this work? And how can I put this? Where will this go? And choosing and selecting details and trying to be in some way objective enough so that people were human, they were complex. They weren't all good, they weren't all bad, they were just like we are, just human. And that was my struggle all the way through, not to idealize anybody, not to demonize anybody, but try to give them the breath of life that I thought they deserved if I were going to go and dredge them up from my memory. And the strangest thing about memory is that you dredge people up, they become alive again, and then you rest them again, you bury them again. And that is a weird kind of process when you think about it. But maybe when you read this book, you will find yourself having a relationship with it very different from mine. You will have different land that you're referring back to. You'll have different associations with family members. But I can tell you one thing for sure, that family is kind of profound. And no matter how banal it tries to be, it somehow ends up being the most important, profound thing in our lives and carry with us all the way through. I am the last person of my siblings, but here tonight are people, relatives of mine, that came all the way across the country to be here tonight, and I am so grateful for them. First of all, my sister Camilla, who figures in this book, her son John Kelly is here. And I have to tell you, John Kelly is one of the sweetest human beings that I've ever known. But that's because he's my nephew. And my daughter Allison Troxell is here. She designed the cover of this book. And I think there's something kind of brilliant about my daughter Allison. But then she's my daughter. So what else can I say? And that's her partner with her, Cindy Levitt, who is my daughter. And I'm happy to claim her as my daughter. There is my niece, my brother Jim Hansen's daughter, Anastasia Hansen, came from Oregon. Here she is, this beautiful woman. Thank you so much, Stacy, for coming, because when I see you, I think of your father, whom I love beyond the beyond. And a new relative that showed up that I've never met before, Mark Salisbury. And Mary Beth has a way of conjuring up these people and bringing them to me, and my family has been exploding ever since. And thank you, Mary Beth, so much. But I gave her a charge once. I said, Mary Beth, go find my nephew Keith. I told her a little bit. She showed up finding my nephew Keith, and he comes for Christmas every year with his boys. And he comes in the summertime, and he's my brother Roger's son, and he's a wonderful man, wonderful man. There's so many of you that tonight I want to thank, particularly Larry Knopp. He's here. He wrote the foreword, that wonderful foreword to my book. He wrote it. I just wondered if I should ask him. He's a busy man, and he was so gracious, and thank you. He did it right away, sent it off, and he almost writes perfect prose the first time through, which can make a person like me kind of resentful. And the two people that got me on this journey, Karen Waller, my lovely, lovely friend and colleague, and also from Plentywood. And we sat next to each other and found out that she was from Plentywood, and she's gone back. Larry and I and Karen had a most wonderful trip back to Plentywood and showed me everything, and we just had 3 days. It was absolutely, could never be repeated, because when you get magic, you understand that magic is magic because it can't be repeated. It was delightful. And Mary Beth, who gave me the Christmas card and slid it across and said, read it now, in which she said, you need to write that book. And for all of you, some of you are my students, I want to tell you that I could weep thinking how sweet you are. Best students I had at Bozeman Senior High, you were the best, absolutely the best. And for all of you friends that have stuck with me all through these years, I want to tell you how grateful I am for your friendship. It is something I can hardly articulate because I'm so full of good feeling about it. It's lovely. And I think this is what community is about, where we are together for an event and we try to make it happen the best we can. Thank you so much for coming tonight. Now there's this book. And I guess I was going to sing a song for you.
Whoa.
Thank you for the applause. I'm back in the saddle again. Back where a friend is a friend. That's the only I remember of that. But the one I do remember is, My home's in Montana. I wear a bandana. My spurs are of silver. My pony is gray. When riding the ranges, my luck never changes. With foot in the stirrup, I gallop away. So, anyway, I've been thinking of cowboy songs because I am that cowgirl temporarily. I want to tell you about a couple of surprises I had when I wrote this book. And one was that I found these letters from World War I from my uncles.
Wow.
And they're in the book. I had this little folder that my mother, when my grandfather and grandmother died, she gave it to me. And I never looked to see those letters. But I knew there was a letter my mother wrote home when she was first married, real sad girl, missing her folks. So I found these letters and started reading these letters from these boys from World War I, dated 1918. And I don't know, it took me back there to the mystery of the whole thing, that they would never understand that some niece of theirs at 85 years old found their letters and put them in a book. Because they are cowboys. They leave the ranch and the world is so open to them. And life is so much easier everywhere but in Plentywood, and they never really are happy with the ranch again. So there are those letters, and I have one here, and I just want to show you that it is an authentic letter. Here it is. But anyway, there's no envelopes, and it's really old, faded writing. But this is from Boyce. And what's interesting about this letter is that my Uncle Boyce, the ranch is close to Canada, and he and my Uncle Cease went over there, and they shot a deer. And the mounted police caught them. And the mounted police apparently pulled a gun or was going to arrest them. But my Uncle Boyce thought he was going to kill them, so he shot him. And then they ran like hell back across the border. And so he went to my grandfather and he said, I don't know if I killed him or not, but this is what happened. And my grandfather said, you leave right now. You leave this country right now. And there is a part in the book where my mother sees my Uncle Boyce leave on Lamar, the most beautiful horse on the ranch. And they didn't hear from him for a long time, but he showed up in World War II, because apparently they didn't have ways of checking backgrounds then. So he went into World War II. And he wrote to his folks from there, but never went back to the ranch again. So there are stories like that about soldiers that really, really surprised me, that I had this at my disposal. The other thing that surprised me is that how many wars we've been in as a country. Because the Civil War sent people looking for a new kind of life, because the South was gone forever and that way of life. There were jobs, but no money. And so there was this drift back to where there was some free land. And then there was the Civil War. There was World War I. There was World War II. And in this book, there's right up to Vietnam, and that struck me as incredible, that there could be that much war in such a new country, because we're not even now a very old country. So those were things that I learned along the way. So shall I read to you from this little bit?
Yes, please.
So anyway, this book starts out with how it all began. It is a breezy day in Seattle, with effervescent clouds, a lightness in the air. I love this town and come here often to visit a half-brother, Stanley Iverson. I am happy to be walking down Pine Street in an old summer dress and worn sandals to meet two women whom I have never met. I am 57 years old, and if my calculations are right, Jardis must be 71, and Camilla 68. They are my sisters. These half-sisters felt old wounds, the breakup of their family, their father and my mother scandalizing the town by their affair. I stop in my tracks, realizing that all the participants of this time of turmoil know each other, except my two brothers and me, who are new to the conflict. We are the bastards, the illegitimate children of our father and mother. As I get closer to the Bon Marché and the restaurant where we are to meet, I feel a flush of anxiety. My palms are sweaty. How will we know in the noontime throng of lunch seekers who we are? We have made no arrangements such as, I will be waving a red rose, or I'll be the one with the black tam. We have done nothing to guarantee that we will find each other. Outside the Bon Marché, I stop. There are so many stories about all of our families. I have lived my life in a vast and complicated narrative resulting in deep sorrows, sharp angers, melancholy minds. I think of my mother, her unconventional life, her drinking and losses, and her stories, always her stories. I see the image of my father, thoughtful, with his high forehead and crisp curly hair. I take the elevator up to the fourth floor. I step through the door into a crowd of people. I stand there, uncertain, looking around. Two women get up from a bench and come toward me. We'd know you anywhere, they say. That's how I met my two sisters that I'd never met from my father's first family. And strange and miraculous and all those things. So, do you have a complicated family? Raise your hands if you do. Yay! The complicated families. So, I have a few other things here. My mother's folks left the Plentywood and went to Oregon, and she stays behind. And actually, my mother left the ranch. She did not get along with her mother, my grandmother. And this is part of something that happened that shows a little bit of the spirit of my mother. After the Chapmans uprooted and went to Oregon, Marie Chapman was without family, but she was in familiar surroundings. There is a story she loved to tell of her initiation into the Eastern Star, the women's auxiliary to the Masons, the popular organization of the solid citizenry of the town. She was to come up with something to entertain the crowd, and her choice shows a playful, even audacious confidence about her. The house party was held at the home of Adolf Reba, the town banker and prosperous farmer, with all the respectable members of the community attending. Marie came down the stairs to laughter and applause as Theda Bera, the vamp, brandishing feathers to conceal her barest of skin. Confident and fresh, she was a hit. Old friends of her family came from Outlook, Raymond, and Scobie to be present at this important occasion, because her father couldn't be there. But that was my mother. I can just think of that young girl coming down the stairs naked with these boa feathers around. And she was accepted and so loved in that community. And that is where we're probably one of the things that makes the story a little sad. Here's a part about my father. Through the years, old friends and acquaintances of Rodney's who knew somehow that I was his daughter had stories to tell about my unknown father. There was always the affirmation that he was good and fair sheriff, egalitarian, treating everyone equally under the law. As a freshman at the University of Montana in the autumn of 1952, to help with my college expenses, I worked weekends and holidays as a waitress. I belonged to the Hotel Employee and Restaurant Employees International Union. I would often go to the union office to see what jobs were available. I don't remember how she happened to know about me personally, but the union secretary asked me if my father was Rodney Salisbury. She told me that she was from Plentywood and knew him, and that he was a wonderful, generous man. Quote, "He gave me and my husband $50 during the Depression so we could get married. We've never forgotten your father. He is remembered by many of us. Whenever I needed a job, she was especially kind and helpful. And whenever I saw her, she would greet me warmly and say to me, 'I wish you had known your father, Joanne. You would have liked him so much.'" I write a lot in the book about Arlie towards the end, where I grew up and where my mother moved after my father died. And so I'd like to read a little bit from that. "We didn't know it then, but the train and its destinations to other parts of the world became fixed in our imagination. The world extended beyond this place, this bit of time. On the other side of the house was Finley Creek, which ran through our land. The two points of departure were parentheses around our lives for all the time we lived in Arlie. Finley Creek was a constant source of adventure for all three of us and our friends. We all fished, and many times the fish we caught were our supper, those little firm brook trout. On summer days and weekends, Roger and I got up early and with a can of worms and our handmade fishing poles, headed for the creek and our favorite spots for catching those wily little trout. At the end of our favorite fishing holes was a flat, open space where we had stashed a sack of salted flour, some butter, and a frying pan. We gathered sticks, built a fire, cleaned our fish, and tossed them in the frying pan. Where they curled up, they were so fresh. We ate whatever we caught for our breakfast, cleaned the pan, put out the fire, stashed the sack of flour, and searched the pasture for our horses. We spent those summer days roaming the hills and valleys of Arlie on horseback, swimming and wading in Finney Creek, and only hunger and our chores drove us back to that little house by the tracks and our mother. In later years, I would reflect that being neglected most of the time and left to our own minds and imaginations gave us the freedom to explore the hills and valleys of Arlie. It left an indelible mark on us. We absorbed its many seasons into our psyches and never tired of its ever-changing beauty. On mellow autumn nights, memory takes me back to Arlie and wandering the countryside with Roger and our friends. The harvest moon is low and we are transfixed in his golden light. We go to Huey's house and throw small stones on his basement bedroom window and he sneaks out to join us. Hungry, we dig potatoes and find corn left from the harvest. We dig a hole, put rocks in the bottom, then the potatoes and unshucked corn, more rocks, and build a fire on top. While it cooks, we sit on the bank of Finley Creek, singing and joking, sometimes quietly talking. The corn is tender, the potatoes perfect. We are awed by our own youth and the possibilities that lie ahead. We cannot find our way home until the moon falls away, the stars fade, and a smear of light appears in the east. Then we walk out of the sacred circle into the light of a new day, into our future. Thank you very much. If you have questions, and my hearing is very poor, my dears, but Mary Beth will take the questions given to me, and I will answer them as best I can. So, any question at all, you can even ask what kind of panties I wear.
little cowboys on them.
That's a private joke, darling.
What sort of panties do you wear?
With cowboys on them. Jack.
So where did the title of the book come from?
The title of the book comes from the beginning when she meets her sisters and they're talking. They're bringing up common things. And my sister Jarda says, well, you know, they were waiting for the revolution. And we all laugh and say, yeah, our folks, you know, were waiting for the revolution. So I use that as a title. And I'm glad it makes me happy, Jack. I mean, the hardest thing is beginning something, ending something, and finding a title. You know that. You know that. Any other questions?
How did your mother deal with her idea of socialism and when that collapsed and they realized that it wasn't what they thought it was? Because that was their whole life. How did they proceed forward from that?
That's a very important question. Because they both thought that they could bring about a revolution because the Russian Revolution had happened. And they both thought that if they worked and that people would understand about justness and fairness and so on. And they were communists. And then they began to hear what was happening in Russia. And the disillusionment was incredible. Because one thing that my mother and father could not deny was the truth. They could not support any longer the idea of the revolution when Stalin had so betrayed everything that it was supposed to be about. And I think that's what people kind of forget when you think of the ideal of communism and the reality. And the reality was brutal, very brutal. Yeah. And so how my mother handled it was that they were still Trotskyites because he believed in having a democracy. You know, he really had a very enlightened way that it should be, but he was driven out of Russia and later killed in Mexico. But my mother still held to the basic ideas that injustice, I mean, it rode with her all of her life. And she hated wars. She thought they were exploiting the poor, that the munitions factories made money on them. And her idea of patriotism was to have no wars at all. And she still carried that philosophy, but no longer was involved with the communists. But the thing is that we loved all things Russian. We love Russian dancing, we love Russian ballet, we love Russian music, and we love Russian novels. So, you know, there was that juxtaposition between the people of Russia and what they did. And I have probably one of the greatest collections of Russian poets. And one of the things that the poets lost was their country. They were either had to leave or they were in Siberia. And poetry has so much to do with your roots and where those roots are. And so I was deeply steeped in that kind of literature. And so it was natural for me to... How many of you in here have, like, Russian ballet, the Bolshoi? You know, it's incredible. Or how many of you have read Russian writers? There is something grand about people anywhere, and their suffering is means that we're all related in that suffering. So it's a great question. Thanks. I've been wanting to say something like that. Anyone else?
It appears that there were many of your family members that were very supportive of this book, but did you run into some that preferred that you not bring some parts of the family history to light or anything like that?
Well, you know, they're all gone. If you wait long enough to write a book, you don't have to worry about that. You know? But you're absolutely right, because I'm sure that my one sister, my half-sister, would have just huffed and puffed about it, but too bad. I'm here, she's not. But I'd like to say something else, too, that I couldn't have written this book when I was 30. No way. Or 40. Young mother, raising profession, 50. I was very engaged in all kinds of grassroots organizing. And in my 60s, I traveled all over the world. And in my 70s. So in some ways, you have to be 80 in your 80s before you can write a book exactly like this. But don't let that discourage you, because some people write 3 or 4 biographies, autobiographies. And you know, when they're 1 to 20 and they do that one and they do 20 to 40, I can't do that. I can only do this one. And so I think that I needed that time to have enough reflection and balance in my own life. To be able to give the people a fair chance that I wrote about, and a real chance, and to be honest about them. And Jane has said to me various times, how come you weren't more angry? And I would like to tell you a story about that anger. When I was teacher, and we'd meet some my teacher friends every Friday, we'd have coffee, and we'd talk about our mothers. And when I'm 40, all of a sudden I realize that I've got this daughter, Allison, who is 5 years old. And I look at her and I think, is she going to get to be 40? And is she going to sit with people and talk about her mother? And I thought, this is getting too close for comfort now. I'm not the perfect mother either. So I told my friends, I said, we got to quit talking about our mothers. We've got to accept our mothers. We've got to accept them for who they are and that we're a part of them. And that if they've got some bad seeds, we probably have some right down the aisle with them. And I know they were kind of resentful because we had a lot of camaraderie around that, talking about our mothers. But I got over it because when I was a mother, I knew that I would have to apologize for a lot of things. Just as you, as mothers, have fathers, have done that, have looked back and said, I wish I'd done something a little different. We all do. So anyway, Allison, thank you for forgiving me. And I think that if you feel like you need to write a book about your family, you should do it, because you learn a lot. I learned a lot doing this book. And sometimes 2 o'clock in the morning, I'd wander around kind of weepy because I'd resurrected them and then I had to say goodbye to them again. And that was sometimes hard. And I miss them. I miss them in that way that they're not here tonight. They'll never read this book. But I hope that there will be that little moment of immortality for those interesting people when you read this book. And then it will go on the shelf, and other books will come, and other readers will be here, and we'll move on. That's the way of it. Mm-hmm. It's the way of life. Mm-hmm. So I'm ready for the next question.
Is this your only book, or your only published, or do you write for yourself and your family?
Well, I wrote a book of poetry, and June Safford is here and wrote this wonderful book. It got inspired, Bozeman from the Heart. And 25, or was it 28, writers from Bozeman are in that book. And that book is so astonishing, and I hope if you don't have it that you'll get it, because there isn't one poor writer in that book, and the paintings are wonderful. It's just the kind of book that you want hanging out on the coffee table, because no matter where you open it, you're going to have a surprise and a revelation. So I think we ought to give a hand to June Safford for a wonderful book.
Joanne was one of the first people I asked when the idea came to me, and here she was engaged in this book, and she found the time and the generosity to say yes, and you know if you see the book and you read her piece. It's fantastic.
Thank you. Yes, Karen.
How much of an impetus was The Red Corner, another book with featuring your father? Was that a big impetus?
Oh, that's really interesting, Karen, because Karen is the person that got me into Pachachka. Red Corner came out, and it was by a woman, Gina Verlaine Stoner McDonald. Is she of your about your age, or is she a little older?
Younger than I am.
Yeah. So she knew that when Red Corner came out, which was about everybody in Plentywood. Well, Karen bought tickets to Pachachka, and then a friend that was with us says she wants you to, and she, to do a Pachachka presentation. I said, what? So anyway, Karen and I got together. I read the book, and Karen and I got together, and we submitted, and here we were, these English teachers. We were, did it perfectly, and they turned us down. So we went, well, hum, this is not really reasonable. So we did it again. My thinking that maybe Karen, I've forgotten, but we did it again, and they turned us down again, because then we said we wanted two slots, because we couldn't get her growing up in that area and me going more personal in 6 minutes, 40 seconds. We couldn't do it. We needed two, back to back. Finally, we called Dee, and we said, could we meet with you? And we met with her, and we explained to her, and she was absolutely with us then, all the way. She said, oh, of course, of course. So finally, Karen and I were looking at each other like, somebody finally appreciates us and our efforts. And so we did the Pachachka thing, and that was, I assumed the role of my mother and why she fell in love with a communist sheriff in Plentywood, Montana, circa 1924, when she had two children and he had six. So, you know, we have a lot of relatives.
In the Red Corner, it mentioned that that portion of history in Montana and Sheridan County, that was never talked about in the schools.
No.
Do you think that that has changed at all since that book?
You know, it wasn't talked about anywhere. In fact, I looked at historians that wrote about Montana High, White, and Handsome. It's never been mentioned. So that's why when the Red Corner came out, it was like, wow. And Larry had been a part of that. And Larry, just talk a little bit, if you don't mind, about how you wrote the preface, how you got interested in Plentywood, because he's a perfect example.
Okay. I have to make it short.
Anyway, he's a part of uncovering this mystery that was going to conceal.
Yeah, so there were a couple of things that had been written. Charles Vindex wrote something in Montana, the magazine of Western History, in about 1968, I believe. I think there was one other article in that magazine. Jerry Zahavi, a historian from SUNY Albany, wrote an award-winning paper in 1996 in a journal called Great Plains Quarterly that was really about the culture and politics and cultural politics of the radical era in Sheridan County. And I came to it all because of an interest in electoral politics. And I noticed, I talk about this in the foreword, how Sheridan County voted differently than Daniels County, which is demographically identical, but very different in terms of its voting patterns. And I got curious, and Jerry Zahavi and I connected, and we came to Plentywood to interview a number of people. Verlaine's mother helped us set those interviews up. Jerry was making a documentary. I was pursuing my interest in the connections between the past and the present. And in the course of that, Jerry said, oh, by the way, Rodney has a daughter who's in Bozeman, and she wants to talk. So I got back to Seattle, and I immediately reached out to Joanne, and the rest is history. Does that answer the question?
Yeah. Okay. What is really interesting is that Jerry and Larry were also interested in my mother. Most people were interested in my father, the communist sheriff. But all of a sudden, these two guys are saying, well, what about your mother? We're interested in her.
And also their relationship. One of the burning questions for me, which you've now cleared up, was how did your mom and dad make that relationship work in this little community while they're still married and living to their living with their respective spouses? Yeah. That's a pretty tricky thing.
Really? It is, and that is actually a lot of the story is about that. And they were scandalized. I mean, My father was very well loved in Plentywood until all this started to unfold. And my brother Gene talks about when Rodney would walk down the street of Plentywood, that it would take forever, and Gene would just sit down, or he'd just go ways, and because people would say, Rodney, could I have a word with you? And so all up and down Plentywood, people would talk to him. And he had a great spirit. He was great fun, and he was totally radical, totally. And so he was loved. And my mother, of course, you know, see the bear coming up, but her folks had opened up that country for homesteading, and they were totally respectable. And here was my mother and the sheriff meeting, fell in love, and had to, they just couldn't go out and live together. That wasn't in the book at all at that time. So it was scandalous, you guys. It really was. It created incredible furor. And my father lost the election in 28 to become sheriff again. And, I mean, that's the story. And the thing, there wouldn't be a story if they hadn't done all those things. So I guess I'm grateful. And I guess I'm grateful to be here. Yes. And it's kind of funny because John's mom, Camilla, is in the strike. But only once, and as she got older, she lapsed once, and she looked at me and she said, "Why did she do it?" And I was sort of taken aback, and I said, "Oh, so that I could be your sister in your old age." And I took her hand. But anyway, then she immediately said, "Oh, of course," and you know, and that was one of those moments we had, one of those eyeball to eyeball moments, you know. So, and all those half brothers were wonderful. They were actually wonderful people. And because my father died so young, and because they knew that I was going to have a kind of a tougher time, they thought, they were there giving me advice and hanging out with me. And they were saying things like, "Don't be just a cute girl. There are millions of those. Mm-hmm. Be a smart girl." Mm-hmm. They were kind of making me cultured instead of just a wild girl, which I had a tendency to be, as you can tell. So, any other questions?
Have you sold the movie rights?
Oh, that's really funny. You and my daughter, Allison. Actually, a couple of the Smith brothers are sort of interested in it. And it's kind of interesting. You can see when you read it what you think. But some people say that it just seems so willing to be a movie.
Yeah, that's true.
I don't know, because I'm not exactly, you know, I love movies, but I don't see how that would translate. And then we sent it off to a friend of ours who is a movie maker, and she's working with Reese Witherspoon. And she'll read it and she'll see what she thinks. But in my life, I don't really count on it, and I don't really care that much. You know what I mean? It's not a big thing to me. So it's out there. Somebody said make a great Netflix thing, and I go,
"Who do you want to play you?"
Carol Smith.
Yeah. Elizabeth Taylor.
Charlie. Missed that one.
Darn, missed the boat there. You know, it's funny because somebody did say, Camilla, your mom, she said that she knew exactly who should play Rodney. I've forgotten who it was. But she was one of her favorite actors. She said, "I think he should play Rodney." So she already was thinking about movies, and I was just kind of going, why?
Wasn't it Gregory Peck?
Gregory Peck. Oh, yeah, but he's already got a role that is definitive. We want a whole new blood on. I mean, maybe that person's being born right now. And they're going to play the part of Rodney Salisbury in about 22 years. Anyway, you were in a great audience tonight. And I thank you so much for coming.
You're welcome.
You have just heard a recording of the celebration at the Country Bookshelf of the publication of Bozeman octogenarian luminary Joanne Troxell's book, Waiting for the Revolution, a Montana memoir published by Sweetgrass Books. This has been a Beyond the Deep End production recorded on February 12, 2020, and produced by Joy LaClaire for Gallatin Valley Community Radio, KGVM Bozeman.